All right, so today we're in part four, right? Part four of unity and division in the body. And in this part, I want to make sure that what we're covering here is, I want us to understand that unity doesn't come naturally. Unity does not come naturally, okay? It just doesn't, okay? Unity will come naturally, however, if we accomplish this, which is removing all of the things that cause us to divide, the issues, all the divisive things must be cleaned up and removed, and then we will naturally be able to come into unity. But as our fleshly beings are still in leadership, in our sovereignty, in our self, okay, that fleshly self, as long as it's sitting on the throne, unity is not natural. It's not a fleshly thing. It's a spiritual thing. It's not an earthly thing. It's a thing from above. You know, Yeshua said, I want you to be one as Father and Son are one. I'd like you to be one as my Father and I are one. That's a higher level than the flesh is capable of. Okay, it's a higher level than the flesh is capable of. Okay? And so, let's understand that unity will come and actually be natural when we get to the maturity level that comes from cleaning out and cleansing ourselves of all of the divisive issues, the things that make us divide. And that's where we get things like needing things to be our own way, or needing to be right, or being easily offended, or all the things we've been talking about now for a couple of weeks. Okay? All the things we've been talking about now for a couple of weeks. And so I want us to be clear and sure to understand that if we can get those things dealt with, which is why I've taken a one-part teaching or so here, and I'm sort of dragging it out, because I want to make sure we're digging into and trying to really root out. This is kind of like a cancer that if we leave any root of it, it will metastasize and take over the body again. And so we don't want that. Okay, we want to make sure we've gotten it all out. And so as we are going through this study, I want us to have that mindset and framework to understand that, because somebody actually came up to me earlier, and I thank you for doing it, saying, well, I know you're talking about all this division stuff. When are you going to talk about the unity? The unity will happen all in its own if we get rid of all of the stuff that's causing division. So it's a great question, which launched into the beginning of the teaching, because that's really it. Torah observance would be simple, right, if everybody was doing it. Why do we struggle with our Torah keeping? Because people say, oh, that stuff is so hard. Nobody can keep it. Well, why not? What's so hard about it? I mean, let's be honest. Is it hard to keep Saturday instead of Sunday or whatever? Is it harder to eat a little different than you used to eat before? I mean, if you get the fleshly stuff out of it, the I don't like, I prefer, I want, I like. If you get all that out of it, what's so hard about keeping Torah? Nothing. The only difficult thing with Torah is you. It's that fleshly stuff. If we can get you out of the mix, if we can die to self and put on Messiah, it's not tough at all. It's not tough at all. So now I'm going to get us, let's go to James chapter 1. And I want us, in doing so, remember last time we were talking about becoming the type of person that Yahweh wants to spend eternity with. And so I want to do a little bit of a contrasting. This is going to be fun. I know you're going to love this. We're contrasting you to Yeshua. Okay? We're going to make a contrast, a little bit of a contrast between you and Yeshua. And so we're going to go through James chapter 1 here, and then we're going to look at some of these other things. But I want us to look at how does this all fit together? You know, we've been talking about things that cause division, talking about the maturity issues, okay? And then I want to read James chapter 1 in that context. We're going to read the whole chapter here, pretty much. Yaakov, verse 1, a servant of Elohim and of the Master Yeshua Messiah, to the 12 tribes who are in the dispersion, greetings. So first and foremost, let's understand who the audience is. Okay, remember we talk about context. In the past, I've told you, context starts out with who's speaking, who are they speaking to, why are they even talking about what they're talking about, When is this happening? Where is this happening? In other words, what are all of the things that are important to know? Well, here it's Yaakov, a Talmud, right? He's a student, a disciple. That's Talmud, not Talmud, okay? He's a Talmud of the Messiah himself. And he was trained and he was made a shaliach, a sent out one. He was sent with a training message to disciple others. And so he is now speaking to who? The lost and scattered full tribes. Not just the 10 that were scattered, but also a lot of the 2 were scattered. He said, I'm talking to the 12 tribes who were in dispersion. You know what? That's us. We're part of that. Because we're still in dispersion, aren't we? And we've already gone through the identity, discovering your identity teachings that talk about that you're supposed to be the 12 tribes. Whether you're grafted in or naturally in is irrelevant, but you're supposed to be part of the 12 tribes. So he's saying to you and the 12 tribes who are in dispersion, I'm writing to you. So this isn't to the Gentiles. This isn't to the fleshly and worldly. These are to those that should be in the camp. Those inside the camp. They're scattered and dispersed, but they're in the body. He says, my brothers, and that's why he calls them brothers, my brothers, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. Okay, I think we should just close the book because Yaakov's crazy. I thought that the first time I read that. Count it all joy when you fall into various trials? That doesn't make any sense if you stop right there, but let's continue and he'll tell you why that's important. Knowing, verse 3, knowing that the proving of your belief works endurance. That's why we count it joy. Trials prove your belief and help you develop endurance. See, Yahweh, I know he knows your heart. I know he knows your thoughts, but he wants, and it's his choice, not mine. He wants to see it in action. He wants to see it in the three-dimensional world. He doesn't want to just hear it out of your mouth or hear it in your heart or hear it in your mind because he knows your thoughts. He wants to actually witness it with his eyes. He wants to see your belief in action. And that's what James chapter 2 ends up being about. He says, look, I'm going to show you my works by my actions. He says, look, count it all joy when you go on these trials because it's going to prove your belief. Prove it to who? To you and to him, to 2. You're going to prove to yourself what kind of belief you have, and you're going to prove to him what kind of belief you have. Because you may be claiming a whole bunch of stuff that you really are not ready for. You think you are. You talk the talk. And some of you are talking that talk in a somewhat prideful, braggadocious sort of way. Only to have Father say, okay, you talked it real big. Now let's see what happens. I'm going to put you to the test. Be careful what you say. Be careful what you ask for. You know, you talk the talk, he's going to want to make sure it's real. And he chooses to see it in a three-dimensional world. So he says, look, you should count it joy because those are opportunities to prove to yourself and to the Father where your belief is, where your faith is, your trust, your emunah. That's the Hebrew for the faith, belief, and trust. So you should know that. This is something you should know. You should have a relationship knowing and deep understanding that trials are to prove belief. Trials are not just to straighten you out, although they do because it's through proving belief that they do. In other words, you're in a trial and it's because there's a part of you that you've not cleaned up yet or maybe you've made some mistakes. Maybe that's why you're in that one particular trial. But see, now you're going to prove whether you believe him that what he tells us, and we're going to go to Deuteronomy and read this, that he gives you this chastisements, this corrections, so that you'll come out of it because he loves you. And do you believe that? Do you believe that he allows the trial to come upon you because it's going to help clean you up and grow you into the image of the Son? That's part of the belief that he wants to see. And so it's also going to create a strengthening of your endurance. And that's why at the end of each book, when we go through the Torah portions, we say, Chazak, Chazak, Venis Chazik, which means be strong and may we be strengthened. Because we need to be strengthened. And that's what Yaakov is talking about. He says, as you go through these trials, if you count it joy, because actually you should be thinking, okay, I know this is terrible. I know I'm going to hate this right now, but it's an opportunity to show my father how far I've come. It's an opportunity to show myself how far I've come. Because you're harder on you than anybody else. And though maybe he puts you in a trial that you absolutely can handle, but you don't think you can. And you'll prove to yourself, wow, I didn't know I'd come that far along. And that's a big part of this whole thing, is that you'll learn about you. He says, and then this endurance, he says, and let that endurance have a perfect work, so that you be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. In other words, through that endurance, you realize, oh, I was able to handle this. And then he's going to stretch you and say, actually, you can handle even more than that. Let me help you recover from what you just went through. Let me build you up and grow you some more. And then we're going to bring another one, only worse than the last. So don't be all that like, ah, oh, good, that trial's over. Another one's coming. As long as you're still breathing, still above the, or, you know, not buried in the ground and waiting on the kingdom, you're going to still have more and more trials. You know, if you're not having any trials, you would start to wonder if the Father even cares about you. He says he chastises every son that he loves. And so he says, look, let this endurance have a perfect work. In other words, the endurance is to then say, okay, now that I endured that trial and I've counted it joy and I learned what I needed to about me and I showed him what he needed to see about me, now let me take all that information and knowledge and move it forward to the next step. This is the baptism of fire teaching, if you remember that, right? Okay, you go in the water, you get washed clean, you come out, you start to grow and learn and develop, and then he allows a trial, a fiery trial, to then test and prove what that building that you've been building was really made out of. And then you learn from it, okay, because some of the building fell apart, some of it stood, and then you're going to have to go strengthen the parts that fell apart, and so that you're ready for the next one. And the next one comes, and less of it hopefully falls apart, and more of it stands as you keep going forward. He says, verse 5, he says, if any one of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of Elohim, who gives to all generously and without reproach, and it shall be given to him. But he should ask in belief, not doubting, for he who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind. So now, let's deal with this a little bit. Part of what we're going to talk about today, and we're probably not going to cover it all today, we'll have to get into it in the next part, which will be in a month, okay? Give you a chance to recover from all this, okay? But part of what we're going to cover in this teaching is understanding who you're supposed to be getting your information from and your guidance from. So look at here. He says, if any of you lacks wisdom, go ask somebody on the internet. Go ask somebody on Facebook that you don't know. Go ask your best friend or your cousin or your sister. What does he say? Go inquire of Elohim. Ask of Elohim. But now notice, though, verse 6 helps you understand that it's not just asking Elohim directly. This is not just about direct download. He said, but he should ask in belief, not doubting, for he who doubts is like a wave of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. So he who doubts is driven back and forth. Is it because you're not listening directly to Elohim? Or is it because you went through representatives or should have gone through representatives, and because you didn't get the solid information? Let me rephrase that because I garbled it up pretty good. You get tossed to and fro because you've not done with faith and belief and trust. You've not found those anointed, appointed you were supposed to find. And then get into submission and into a discipleship relationship with that anointed, appointed, so that you would not be tossed to and fro, because now you're asking and doing things that are wisdom. It is very unwise to try to do this on your own. It just is. It's foolish. Nowhere do you see in Scripture people doing it on their own. This is a group activity. But it's not a group activity that's chaos. It's a group activity with structure and with leadership and with authority. And so you get tossed to and fro because you don't have an authority that can keep you from getting tossed to and fro. Because what happens is you're trying to find the teachers or the teachings either one, that are meeting the needs you have, but in the way you want it to be met. You already know how you want the answer to be. You're looking, you're asking, you're seeking, you're knocking, you're asking for wisdom, etc., but you already have your own perception of what that should look like, and so you're looking for that. So you come to one teacher or teaching, and you go, no, that's not the way I would think it would be. I'm going to go look for another one and another one, and you get tossed all over the place. Instead of finding the teacher you're supposed to be with, and everybody, according to Scripture, you're supposed to have a teacher. And I know that goes against what's happening on the internet. People are just absolutely killing the thought process of that you should actually be doing anything but just letting the Ruach teach you. But if all of those guys out there who are being taught by the Ruach are all being literally taught by the Ruach, why are they all on 67 different pages? Is the Ruach confused? You know, we talked about this last week. Is Messiah divided? Well, we don't have structure. And so he says here, look, if you lack wisdom, ask of Elohim. And then Elohim is not going to give you necessarily the direct download, but Elohim is going to give you the guidance to the place where you're going to get the wisdom. Hopefully you get it from teachings like this, or whoever your teacher is. The people got their wisdom from Moses and Aaron, but that was not from Moses and Aaron, it was from Elohim. The people got their wisdom here from Yaakov. Ah, but it's not from Yaakov. It's from Yaakov, from Yeshua, from the Father. The people are getting their wisdom through the direct channel process that leads to the Father. And it's the Ruach that tells you, yep, now you're on the right path. But be careful, you got more than one voice in your head that wants to pretend it's the Ruach. The worst one is you, not the enemy. The enemy is not the worst voice, it's your voice. Because your voice has preferences. So your voice is going to say yes to what you like and no to what you don't like, even if you're wrong. Even if what you like is not good for you, your voice is going to prefer what you like and not prefer what you don't like. So you tend to drift towards the teachers that tickle the ears. See, but we have a wrong definition of tickling the ears. We think tickling the ears is just people that just say nice things. No, you're seeking those that say things you agree with. Now, they also could be the guys who just say the nice things. And we got plenty of those guys out there, huge ministries, who are just saying nice things. But most of you would easily avoid those guys if you're looking to not be having your ears tickled. But what you're still doing, some of you, maybe a lot of you, you're still doing the ear tickling thing when you're looking for the teachers that are going to match you. Instead of finding the teacher you're supposed to go to who's going to challenge you, grow you into the image of the Son. And not match you. I go through this exercise on a regular basis with people. People will come up to me and we'll have a conversation if they're brand new to our ministry, if they're coming to visit here, thinking about attending this on a regular basis, and they want to make sure that I and my positions on things match up with them. And I always look them in the eye saying, they won't. At some point we'll find at least a few that don't match. That's not the point. The point is that Abba sends you here. If Abba sent you here, then this is what you're supposed to be receiving. It doesn't matter if we don't match up. Maybe we don't match up because you've got things that need to be straightened out. And deep down, you know you have that. You know you need that, but it scares you. And that's where some of you are going through the quote-unquote deep work that Abba does because you're allowing him. By the way, he would want to do that deep work with every one of you. Every day, if you would let him. If you would let him. That's where we have Elohim doing the work here. If you would let him. But you have to let him through the anointed appointed teachers who are there to guide and disciple you. Remember, the 12 were not sent out to, and when it said go out and disciple the nations, he didn't say go tell them to just plug in directly. He said you go and teach them and make students of them. And then they will go out and find others to go make students of, those who want to be students. That's the scriptural process. See, but why do we have division? Because people don't want that process. You know why? Because it means you have to submit. And none of us wants to submit. I'm telling you, when I counsel husbands and wives, when I counsel men with their problems in congregations or at their works, Nobody wants to submit. And let's understand the definition of submission. This may mess up some of you. If you agree with what I say and you do it, that is not, big capital N-O-T, not submission. It is not submission until you do it, but you didn't agree with it. There's no submission necessary. Submitting is, you and I don't agree, but I am going to submit to your authority, and I'm going to do it your way because I trust and believe that's what I'm supposed to do, even though I don't agree with you. Then submission comes in. But there's a second part to this. And if you do it, moaning, groaning, and griping, you're still not submitting. If you're going to do it with a long face and a big sourpuss and be all whiny and complaining and mumble and grumble, that's what you see all through the Exodus, right? All through the Exodus, you see Israel doing what? They're submitting, but then they're whining, complaining, and griping. That's not submission. They think they are because, well, yeah, we did it. Okay, we did what you said, you know. But then it didn't work out the way I thought it should be. I thought there should be water everywhere and I should have food and this manna thing is not enough and I'm whining, complain. When I first did the teachings on the Torah portions many years ago and I got to some of those first ones in the desert, I actually subtitled it whine, complain. Because that's what they did on a consistent basis all the time. That's not submission. He brought them out there to teach them submission. Now, why would you submit? Submission is not something forced on you, by the way. If someone forces you to submit, it misses the whole point. It misses the whole point, okay? I didn't bring that in my notes today, but I have it in my notes for the next week, but I'll say it today instead. If I make you, in other words, by intimidation, force, lording over you, whatever. If I make you keep commandments and do certain things a certain way, and you did not want to do it, that benefited nobody. Didn't benefit me. Matter of fact, I'm going to be in trouble for forcing something on you you didn't want to do. And it doesn't benefit you because you can't sit in front of the Father on Judgment Day and said, well, you know, I did all this stuff. And he's going to look in the eye going, yeah, but you didn't want to. You only did it because Rabbi forced you to. By the way, parents, be careful with your children. When they get old enough to be grown adults, stop forcing them. Because if they only do it because you forced them, it doesn't benefit anybody. They need to learn submission, where you have the joyful mindset of saying, I trust you, even if you're wrong. I trust that even if you're wrong, it'll benefit everybody. That Abba will work through you and let you learn your lesson for being wrong. I trust that wrong or right, that by submitting to you, this is what I'm supposed to do because I trust that Abba puts you in that position of authority. If it's a husband with a wife, a boss with an employee, a leadership in congregation with a congregation member. If you can't trust that leader, why are you there? Why would you sit under that leadership? And that includes husbands and wives. Why would you get married to someone you're not willing to submit to? Well, because some of the wives figured he was going to submit to you. That's the upside down, backwards part of the society. And some of the men think dictatorial, you know, dictating, you listen, you do. That's forcing. That's not looking for submission. You want them to do it because they want to do it. They want to submit. If you've got to force them to submit, you don't have a marriage either. You're not a leader. She doesn't trust you. She doesn't believe in you. That's why people don't submit. Trust, belief, faith, missing. So they won't submit. So what happens is you're allowed to go through a trial. You're allowed. You have an opportunity. You are blessed to have a trial that you can count joy because it's going to prove your belief or lack thereof. And you get to now work on it. Okay? It's like taking something out for a test run to see how it works. Or if you're doing you're cooking something for the first time and you made up a new recipe and you go to taste it, and sometimes you go to taste it and you go, ooh. And then you got to figure out what made it taste like that. Because it was missing something or had too much of something. That's life. Okay, life is like tasting the soup, right? You're making a soup, you put in your ingredients, they made it from scratch, and you go to taste it, and if it doesn't taste right, it's got one of two things. It's either missing something, actually I should say three things. Missing something, not enough of something, or too much of something. Something doesn't belong in there. And so now you start thinking, okay, I wonder, did I put too much this, not enough of that? What, maybe if I added this, it would fix it. That's like your trial. The trial opportunity is for you to go through an experience in your life so that you can then analyze, is something missing? Something not enough? Something too much? Something needs to be gotten rid of completely? Because if we could go through those processes, we could grow up finally. I don't mean to say, I don't want to be blunt and insulting, but I happen to be born with blunt, okay? I don't do beat around the bush. I do blunt. But then again, you know what? I read this book. He doesn't beat around the bush either. He's pretty blunt. And so we need to understand that that's why we still have division. That's why we don't have unity. Because as we go through these trials, we're not doing a good enough job of saying, okay, what was I supposed to get out of this trial? What was I supposed to learn about me? Because obviously in this trial, that now bear in mind, I want to make sure I package this right. You're not suffering the trial because you did something wrong necessarily. You're suffering the trial because it's an opportunity for you to learn about you. So maybe it's not that you did anything wrong, but you're not doing enough of something right, and he's trying to get your attention to realize you have something that's not enough of. Not necessarily something was wrong. Some of the trials is you did something wrong and you brought a trial upon yourself. But sometimes he allows a trial to come on you because you're complacent. You're just sort of lackadaisical. You're not putting in the effort, and he wants to show you, yeah, you're moving along okay, but there's some stuff that you're not doing enough of. It needs more. Or maybe it's going to wake you up and say, look, you're getting along okay, but you're still missing this other piece completely. You need to bring this in there, and then we can really move forward. It's an attention getter. Does that make sense? The trials are an attention getter. By the way, it's the same thing in the body. When we have division in a congregation, the leadership looks back and goes, okay, what was missing? What needs to be gotten rid of? What do we need more of? What do we need less of? That, so that what made that division happen? Because the division was to bring attention to something. Okay? And I don't want to insult the people that have left. Many people that leave a congregation and cause divisions because those are the most emotionally challenged people in the group. And so they're not capable of the group dynamic of too many people are getting their way and I'm not getting mine or whatever it is. They're emotionally challenged. And so I wish they would stay and grow, but because they're so challenged and broken in that area, they only have a choice of either forcing everybody to their way or leaving and splitting. If we could get our emotional maturity up to the level it needs to be, none of this would ever happen. Okay, I have a line that I forgot to mention when we were talking about selfless and being offended. I want to give you this line. It came to me, I don't know, months ago. I was just, this is one of those things, the rock just popped up when it came, and I needed it at the right time. If you are offended by anything that happens around you or upset or angered, it simply means that you were not mature enough to handle what just happened. You're all going to get mad at me. If your response to anything that happens around you is anything less than joy, love, peace, patience, the fruit of the Spirit, you were not mature enough to handle what you just experienced. That's the first thing you should be realizing. But you don't understand what so-and-so did to me. Yeah, so what? The reason you're so upset about it is because you're not mature enough yet to handle what just happened. I am so guilty of this, so please don't think I'm thinking that I'm not guilty of this. All right? Because I do pop my cork. I get very frustrated, and I get very angry about really dumb things. And not usually people, usually things, like the computer mostly. It's amazing I haven't like hit it with something. Of course, the fact that I spent a few $1,000s on it, because it's a Mac, you know, kind of protected it from getting beat up as much as maybe a cheaper PC, which I might have been more willing to throw across the room. But every time those things happen, I have to remember it's simply showing I'm not mature enough in that area to handle what was happening. This is where divisions come from. This is why we don't have unity. Most of the body in many, many areas is not mature enough to handle what happens around them, and that's where the splits come from. That's where the attack, because you're not mature enough, you lash out in some way. You lash out in some way. Is this not true? Okay? So next time you're going through something and you're anything but those nine aspects of the fruit, then you know that whatever just happened brought to light, like the trials here in James chapter 1, or Yaakov 1. It brought to light in that area you were not mature enough to handle whatever happened. And that should be a wake-up call to your needing to grow in that area, to your needing to then get to the place where you no longer would react that way. In other words, get to the place where it would not generate the upset, the anger, the frustration, the hurt feelings, the offense, the sadness, whatever it is. I mean, it could, depression. I mean, all spectrums of emotions that you could react to that are not part of the nine aspects of the fruit of the Spirit, which we went over last week. So if any of your reactions are not love, joy, peace, patience, etc., then you are not mature enough in that area. And so all of us need to really think about, okay, instead of me always thinking how the other person needs to, man, if they would just grow up, go to the mirror and say that. If you would just grow up. Because it's so easy to see it in everybody else. You know, it's so easy. And so it says here now, so if you lack wisdom, ask Elohim, who gives generously, he'll guide you to the right person with the right wisdom. And by the way, that doesn't mean you're going to like what they say. Matter of fact, if you do like what they say, you probably should go to somebody else. Unless you like it because you realize they cut right through to what it is and it hurt. And even though it hurt, but you like the fact that they told you straightforward and honest. You know, I've had people walk away from our ministry because they don't like that I just cut right through and straight. I'm sorry, but Abba didn't pick me up and make me a feather duster. He made me a scalpel. Okay? I don't choose that, by the way. I don't think, how can I get up there and cut into everybody today? My wife has asked me in years past, well, can't you just get up there and do something light? Still teach Torah, but just something. I mean, you really are so, man, you're wearing people out with all this heavy stuff. And so I did a teaching called, I'm trying to think which one it was, Rejoice. Boy, that was a light one, wasn't it? But that was my response to trying to fulfill what my wife had asked, because I love my wife, and she had asked me to do something a little bit lighter. So if you remember Rejoice, which I think is a couple of parts, it didn't come across exactly how I, because I'm not in charge up here. And I came up here trying to just do something all nice. Like when you asked, hey, when are we going to just talk about the unity stuff and everything? Well, no, the unity stuff will happen naturally after we get rid of the problem stuff. Okay? So go and ask and seek after the ones that are supposed to lead you into the wisdom. Now listen, to prove all of this, listen for verse 7. For that man should not think that he shall receive whatever from the master. He's a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. The one who is not coming in belief, the one that is doubting, he's the one that's tossed back and forth. That person is not going to receive because that's double-minded. So what's the double mind? That's the mind of Yeshua, the mind of Elohim. That's, you know, you're asking, but it's also you. Okay, that's when you have your own thought process, preferences, and desires that are skewing what you want the information that you're receiving to look like. It's skewing what you're expecting the response to be. It's your filtering. That's your double-minded. Yeshua-minded is what you're trying to be. Let this mind be in you, right? Philippians 2:5, let this mind be in you. And we're actually going to probably cover that here if we get through. I mean, I didn't expect to go this far and not get anywhere yet, but, you know. Actually, I think we've gotten a lot along here. But as we're going through, that mind of Yeshua is at enmity, it's at odds, it's an enemy against your mind, your flesh. Your flesh doesn't want that. Not that Yeshua is the one that's at enmity, but you, it's the flesh is at enmity with him. And so you're a double-minded person. And what are double-minded people? Unstable. Stability is in submission to the Father and the Son. You want a stable life? You want balance? You're going to have to get your own you out of there. You got to get you off the throne. Think of it. I'll use an analogy. We could use either a seesaw or like a boat. All right? If you're sitting at, how many of you all been in boats? I mean, hopefully a lot of you have been in a boat. Okay, if you're not, you've been on a seesaw, you understand what I'm talking about. Okay? If you've got two equally weighted people on the ends of a seesaw, and one of them starts moving towards the other one, the thing gets out of balance. Keep that picture in mind. If you're in a boat, and somebody's sitting at one end of the boat, and they're seated right perfectly at that end of the boat, and you start to move from your spot towards where they are because you want to be in that spot, what's going to happen? The boat's going to get all wobbly and out of whack, tossed to and fro. This is what happens when you walk towards that seat of authority in your own being that he should be sitting on. When you approach that throne of your head, that self-sovereign throne that you need to get off of, and he's sitting in it for a little while, and then you start approaching like, excuse me, I want to sit down for a few seconds because I'd like to take I can handle this one myself. I think I'll sit down here. We'll just go over there for a minute. Oh, he's there for a while because all of you let him do that to some degree or you wouldn't be here. But every now and then you want to kind of, you know, stick your hip out and nudge him out of the seat and get in that chair. As you approach that throne, this is not like approaching his throne. I mean, the one in your own head, you're going to be tossed to and fro. Now you're looking for that authority. You're going to be unstable. It's going to be wobbly. If you actually make it over to the seat and start trying to sit down in it, now you're going to be driving the boat in the wrong direction. Because now you've taken the wheel. And now you're guiding it in the wrong way. So that's how you get to be unstable in your ways. You want stability. There's only stability in one source, him, not you. Have you not looked at your life to see how unstable it is when you run it? Verse 9, let the lowly brother boast in his exaltation, but the rich in his humiliation, because as a flower of the field he shall pass away. For the sun rose with burning heat and the withered the grass, and its flower fell, and its pretty appearance perished, so also the rich man shall fade away in his ways. You know what, I'm not going to get into those two verses for right now. I don't want to dig too deeply into the metaphors, but let's continue into verse 12, okay? Now verse 10 and 11, 9, 10, and 11 absolutely have to do with this teaching. I don't want to kind of have to dig so deeply into that for right now. But trust me when I tell you it's consistent with the theme. And now go to verse 12. Blessed is the man who does endure trial. So now we're continuing with what happened in verse 2 and 3. Blessed is the man who does endure trial. For when he has been proved, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Master has promised to those who love him. We have a teaching called endure and receive the crown of life. You may want to go listen to that. But notice the way it works. When you have been proved. Oh, that sounds like earning. That sounds like I've got to do something and get, you know, I approve of that. I have to do things that are pleasing in somebody's sight. You do. It's not like you were taught in mainstream Christianity. Oh, you made your altar call and you accepted Yeshua as your personal Messiah and blah, 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 blah. And now you don't have to really do anything because he's done it all. No. He says here, when he has been proved, then he shall receive the crown of life. There's no receiving without proving. Oh, how many people have you talked to and how often have you told people, I'm a believer? Really? Can I watch you? Can I see it? Can you prove it? Prove it. What do you mean, prove it? I believe in Messiah. Okay. That's nice. I believe you. I believe you believe that there's a Messiah that existed and exists and will come again. I believe that you believe that. But where's the proof? The proof comes in the trial. Because through that experience, you must actually demonstrate your total belief and trust, or lack, because how you get through the trial, maybe because you lack trust, that's why you suffer. Yeshua, although he was scourged and everything else, he didn't suffer the way you might think because he understood and trusted what the trial was for. It was to prove him to be worthy of sitting at the right hand, of worthy of the crown that he's going to be given to be King of Kings and Master of Masters, etc. He needed to even he needed to prove. Isn't that amazing that he even needed to prove? And what did he receive? The crown of all crowns. He's been crowned with many crowns. He says, let no one say when he's enticed, I'm enticed by Elohim, for Elohim is not enticed by evil matters. He entices no one. So it's not, you. So someone gets in a trial and goes, well, Elohim enticed me into doing that. No. Listen to the next verse. Each one is enticed when he's drawn away by his own desires and trapped. That's what entices you. You. That emotional part of you that likes and doesn't like. But I hate that. I know, but he wants you to do it anyway. But I love that. I know, but he told you you can't do that anymore. But I like it. But I want to. It's not fair. What makes you think you know what fair is? Is it fair that he gives you everything and you ignore him? Or only give him partial attention? Is that fair? So he goes, but each one's enticed when he is drawn away. Drawn away from what? The path he's supposed to be on, the halakha, that path that leads to the kingdom door. When he's led away and drawn away by his own preferences, that's the unstable, the tossed to and fro, the double-minded. That's where you are drawing you away. We've had people leave this congregation that absolutely needed to be here, but they were too self-absorbed, and I'm not saying that in a wrong, like I'm not saying they did it on purpose. They just weren't grown up enough to know that they had so much still to deal with that they ran away. That's why people end up in the alcohol bottle. They end up in the drugs bottle, so to speak. They end up with all these addictive, bad parts. These are escapes. That's why they kill themselves either slowly or quickly. They're still killing themselves when they do some of these things. It just doesn't happen right away. When they live in an abusive, self-abusive place with what we do with through our addictive escapisms, we run into all kind of bad lifestyles. Why? Because we can't deal with our inability to be mature enough to do things his way. Because what his way does, and this is the part we hate the most, his way tells you absolutely without any hesitation that you are wrong. And some part of you, in the way you see the world, is wrong. That it's not lined up with him. Now, he doesn't hate you for it. He doesn't blame you for it. He's just trying to show you, hey, I love you, but you don't understand that this part of your life, this part of the way you're living and the way you see the world, it's wrong and it's hurting you. It's wrong and it's hurting others, and I'm trying to wake you up so that you can see it the right way. I'm trying to get your attention so that you can see it the correct way. But we don't want to know. See, don't tell me I'm wrong. You want to see a fight? Go tell somebody how wrong they are. Oh, you'll see a fight. You'll see one real quick. Tell them you're right and they're wrong. Even if you don't tell them you're right, just tell them they're wrong. You'll get a fight. We don't want to be told we're wrong. But we're told from Scripture, anything that's not the Father-like in its way is wrong. Anything not Yeshua-like in its way is wrong. We have the Son and the Father to show us what is right, what is good. We did a teaching called Well Done, Good and Trustworthy Servant, okay? Good, okay, it says, well done, good and trustworthy and servants. That first part of the teaching was on understanding what scripturally good is. Well, I'm a good person. I don't understand what the big deal is. Are you? Well, I'm a good person. I don't know. What's your measuring stick? Do you know what good is scripturally versus societally. We as a society, we have an understanding of what we think good is, what right is, what wrong is. But what measuring stick are you using? Societies, your culture, your family, how you were raised, where you live, what era you live in, what time period you live in? Or are we going by the Father's word? This is right, this is wrong. This is good, this is bad. But see, again, that we're not emotionally mature enough to be told that and not be offended, upset, depressed, whatever. Because some of you will take it to the extreme on the one side where you'll be like, well, then why try? I'll never be good enough. See, now you're not believing him when he said, I didn't start a work in you that I can't finish. Now you're not believing him when he said, his desire, if possible, that all men can be saved. In other words, you're not believing him when he said, I didn't put you in a trial that I wouldn't also provide a way of escape. But he says here and through Yaakov, these are endurance issues. In other words, you're learning from this one and you'll get another one and another one. Each one, as long as you're growing and learning and growing and learning, you're going to be just fine. But if you're stagnant or going backwards, now we're going to have a problem. He's not expecting you to be perfect yesterday or today or tomorrow. You know, we didn't go to Deuteronomy yet in verse, you know, 8 and verse 2. We're going to get to that whole section in, you know, probably next teaching, because we're going to still be stuck here in Yaakov for a little while. But let's understand, Deuteronomy 8:2 says that he is wanting to see whether it's in your heart to keep commandments, not whether you'll do it perfectly, whether you want to do it perfectly. Where is your heart? Are you doing it reluctantly, kicking and screaming, or casually, or with all your heart, with all your strength, because you want to, okay? But yet we're enticed and drawn away by our desires. Now we see that and we think, oh, desires, we think of like all these terrible vices that people have. No. You desire to just do certain things on Shabbat that really you shouldn't, but you desire them. So if I, you know, I get people, and if you're online live stream, I'm not talking about you, I'm not giving anybody your name. Okay? But people have asked me about Sabbath keeping, and we're going to have a teaching on that at some point soon. You know, is it okay to, and we could fill in the blank with many things, is it okay to go to the gym and work out on the Sabbath? I find that relaxing. It's restful. No. Why are you going to the gym? Is it because he wants you to or because you want to? There's a simple question to answer all your Shabbat questions. Is it something he wants or what you want? Are you going because he likes it or because you like it? Now, I know you like coming to services, but it's also what he instructs you to do, and he likes it. See, sometimes it's both. You can like it and he can like it. And that's actually where it's supposed to be mostly, that you both like it. But when you ask me if you can go to the beach or you can go to the gym or you can go to whatever on Shabbat or hang out at home and watch movies, not Bible movies, but just secular stuff, whatever, or read whatever secular books, these are very restful things. I'm resting. I'm not working. But it's still, you're doing what you want on his day. That's why it says in Isaiah 58, the last two verses, he says, if you would turn away your foot from doing what you want on my day, on my Sabbath, then things are going to really be good. Look at verse 13 and 14 of Isaiah 58 when you get a chance. That's your framework for all your asking me questions. You want to ask me questions? I'm going to send you that verse anyway. How does what you want fill into that two verses? Are you doing what you want on his day? Or are you doing what he wants on his day? Because you know you could work out any day, but you like it. Makes you feel good. And that's what it should. Working out feels good. You pump those good endorphins in your body and you're getting all the blood pumping and it cleans out the system. It's great. But it's not about him. And so when we look at this, saying being drawn away by your desires, that's why we break any commandment we break. It doesn't have to be the most overt things of the things that we think of as like extreme vices and lusts. When you do what you want instead of what he says, this verse is what's happening. When you do what you desire, what you want, desire, and try to spin that's what he wants when it's not anywhere in his word, that's you being drawn away by your own desires. And then you're trapped. And you know what? I didn't really thought about how to deal with this trap thing. I think you're trapped. See, I waited till I got up here. I think, Rock, just give me the words. I'm thinking right now that the trap thing is because now you've convinced yourself that what you're doing is right. And you convince yourself that it's him, that he gave you permission. And now you're going to continue to do it. You're trapped because now you're convinced you're doing right when you're doing wrong. And then there's a second layer to the trap. Most of you will also try to talk to others about it to try to see if they'll agree with you so that you can have a backing up of your opinion. And that's where the division starts to happen. Because now you're talking to others and you're trying to say, well, what do you think of this whole working out and the whole gym thing? Or what do you think of this whole going to the beach and surfing or whatever you want, I mean, whatever you want to do at the beach? What do you think about these things, right? What do you think about going for an hour and a half bike ride? What do you think about, and we're in nature and we're enjoying and appreciating what God's made. Is that really why you're going on the bike ride? Is that really why you're going to the beach? Is that really why you're going to the gym? Is that real? On and on. Is that really why you're going? Look, you want to go for a walk? Go for a walk. Okay, but if you're going on a 5-mile walk, now we're talking that something's a little different. Now you're going for a walk because you really wanted to get some exercise. You're not just going to look at the nature. Do you understand the difference? Okay, it's one thing to go on a short trail and just walk and enjoy nature. It's another thing when you know, okay, let's see, I do normally 3 or 4 or 5, 6 miles a day. I don't want to miss my routine of doing my 5 miles a day. So I'm going to spin this now, you see, so I can do it because it's my desire, and I'm going to trap myself because I'm going to convince myself it's what he wants. Now you're trapped. And you're going to trap others. Because you're going to go around and try to find others that agree with you. Because after all, where two of us agree, no. Where two or three are gathered in his authority, in his name, then he's there. Not just because two people get together and agree on anything. You can go find 3 Christians that can agree on everything that you know is not scriptural. You can find them to back up Sunday, Christmas, Easter, anything you want. Eating pork. You can get 2 or 3 of them together all the time. And they're going to say, well, with 2 or 3 are gathered in my name. Well, just because you use his name, and they're not even using the right one, but just because you use his name doesn't mean he's there. It's in his authority. But see, that's part of what's in the back of our minds, maybe unconsciously, is that, well, I'm going to go get a bunch of people to make me feel like I'm not doing something wrong because you feel guilty. I'm calling you out. You do it because you feel guilty. There's a part of you that knows this is not exactly kosher. And so now to feel better about it, because you really don't want to not do it, you really want to do what you want to do, you're going to go around and you're going to put little test balloons out there with people trying to find a few that'll agree with you. So that you can say, oh, well, you know, well, Susan and Mary and John and Frank and Bob, they all agree with me. They don't think it's a problem. I say, fine, use that and when you go to Judgment Day and see how that works. I don't have a problem with you doing that. That's a big problem for you, though. My problem is if I warned you, that's not a good idea. And I'm going to tell you, that's not a good idea. Okay? But that's where we get trapped. We get trapped because we try to spin, rational lie to ourselves and others. And then once we are convinced in our own minds, we're not going to stop doing it. Or we're not going to start doing something we've convinced ourselves we don't have to do. Because you spun it. There's not a person out there that's against tithing who's not against it because they don't want to give money to anybody. They're only against it because it takes money out of their pocket and puts it in somebody else's. Let's be honest. There's not a person out there that doesn't have Sabbath-keeping issues who doesn't have it because there's something that they want to do on Shabbat. I lost the guy because I busted him, and I did it jokingly because I knew that he would get upset. I tried to be gentle. He took it the wrong way because he went to the Vols game on a Saturday because somebody gave him free tickets. Now, if you're a Tennessee Orange person and you're a Vols fan and the football game is being played and it happens to be on Saturday and those tickets are hard to come by and someone gives you free tickets, that's tempting. That guy never came back after that. He stayed for a couple of weeks and then was gone. Why? Because I was so mean to him? when I said, hey, that was the Vols game. He didn't know I knew. But he was embarrassed. You can avoid all that embarrassment by just doing what you know you need to do. It's like we used to tell people, and I remember hearing this as a kid, why would you, if whatever you're talking about, you wouldn't say in front of your wife or your mother or your sister or your, whatever it is, why would you say it? Whoever it is that you would be worried would scold you for saying whatever's coming out of your mouth. If you've got to pull somebody off to the side to get away from certain people so you could say something, okay, because it's off color, inappropriate, or some sort of, you know what I'm saying? Then why are you saying it? Because our emotions are enticing us. Because it's going to be funny. It's going to get a laugh. Listen, I was the class clown of class clowns. I know what it's like to be enticed to make people laugh. And I did a lot of dumb things because I knew it would make people laugh. And I said a lot of worse dumb things because I knew it would make people laugh. But often at the expense of one person so everybody else would laugh. Oh, but I was so clever. Hey, attention, all you people out there that think you can burn people with those roasts, you can roast people. I'll go toe-to-toe with you any day, and it wouldn't matter because it'd be wrong. And I was so good, and it was awful. I hurt people. I made a lot of people laugh, but they were laughing at somebody, not with. And don't think because I'm out of practice I can't still do it. They still come to my head. They just don't come out of my mouth. Because I was raised in that culture where it was like a badge of honor if you could be fast and right and just cut. But you never cared that somebody was on the other side of that. But why do we do those things? Well, because we're enticed in our own, you know, by our own. I liked how it felt to be not hurting that person, but praised by all of these people that thought I'm so clever and so witty and so sharp of tongue, pleasing all the wrong people. I see the teenagers doing it now today. Oh, roasting is a big thing. Oh, they think they're so clever. Some of them try to do it around me. And every now and then I'll throw one out there just to show them that they're amateurs. And I'm not saying that to brag. And my son could vouch for it. He's seen it. Okay? Actually, you guys all saw it the day that I said, oh, being off by one day. I said, how about the Sunday keepers? And I went, but you got to be careful. This is what the body is still dealing with. This is why the body can't eat meat. They're drinking milk. This is where the body is. We're just not growing up ready to handle things. You know, we're enticed and we're drawn away and then we're trapped. Verse 15, then when the desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it has become accomplished, brings forth death. You know, that verse right there brings out everything I told you guys during the heart of the matter. When I said, look, you get a thought, right? A desire, a thought, and it goes into your heart. It gets emotional, right? It's a desire. It conceives, you take an action. That action over time leads to a destiny. And what he's telling you here is this is the destiny of this particular type of thought process. You think, you desire, you take action. That action ends up being, it turns out it's sin, and sin accomplishes nothing but death. See, that whole process that I taught you for 64 parts of the heart of the matter is right here in Yaakov. You think. You put emotion to it, it births an action. The action, if it's sin, is going to lead to death. If you think, you get emotion attached to it, and the action is good and right, it's going to lead to eternal life. He's simply explaining the process to you. It's not a complicated process. He says, do not go astray, my beloved brothers. Don't go astray. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no change nor shadow of turning. I think we're going to end with this verse. I'll say a few things about it, then we'll end. This is where it's got to be, connecting this to the unstable. If it's a good gift and a perfect gift that came from above, came from the Father of lights, who he does not change, if you were in line with that, you would not change. You would be stable. This is the discussion that I've had with many people where I've had to walk them through why the law has not been done away with. Because they'll be like, oh, well, that's all been nailed to the cross, blah, blah, blah. And I say, okay, let me ask you a question. Does, and I use their own terms, does God change? They say, no, of course not. You know why? They've read this verse. They've read the verse in the Old Testament that says, I am Yahweh, I change not. They've read the verse when it says, Yeshua the same yesterday, today, and forever. So that's an easy one for them. But it comes from right here. It says, look, every good gift and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights. So now, knowing this verse, and I know that they believe Yaakov is telling the truth. I do too. You do too. What does that mean then? He says, okay, if Yahweh says something, it's good and perfect. It's a gift. Oh no, it's that burdensome, horrible, awful law. No, every good gift and every perfect gift from a Father above, and I could even switch that around. Everything from above is a good and perfect gift. It comes from above. So then I asked them, I said, okay, if God doesn't change, then can anything he says is right ever be wrong? Can it? By definition, it cannot. If he says something's right, it will always be right. Otherwise, he's changing. If he says something is wrong, can that ever now be right? No. If it's wrong, it's always wrong. So right is always right, and wrong is always wrong when it comes from him. Otherwise, he's changing. So now I asked the person, I had this conversation at a conference, sitting at a table where a person was eating pork sausage with their breakfast, because this was a Christian conference I was invited to as an observer. And I observed a lot of stuff, I'll tell you right now. But I said this to the person, and I said to them, after going through the process, God doesn't change, right is right, wrong is wrong. Then I say, then how do you eat that pork sausage? And that person looked at her husband and said, we need to change tables. It's not complicated. It's not complicated. And it's right here. Every good gift, every perfect gift is from above, from the Father of lights. And not only does he tell you it's perfect and good, but it enlightens, it illuminates, it shines and shows you the light of the Torah, the light of the truth, the light that's Yeshua. Yeshua, the light of the world. His word, his truth is a light unto a lamp unto our feet. Right, Psalm 119, when he says that thy word, right? But the word we know put on flesh and walked amongst us, Yeshua, our Messiah. So having purposed it, he brought us forth by the word of truth for us to be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. And that's where we're called to be right now. There's more to the chapter. We're going to stop here. But I'm hoping that we're getting this. He did this because he purposed it so that he could bring us forth from where? From the world, from out of the worldly, fleshly mindset, behavior, lifestyle, to be brought forth by the word of truth to be a first fruits of others that would be coming out of her, my people. But to do that, we have to grow up. It's going to take a level of maturity that we're not quite there yet. We're not quite there yet. And until we acknowledge that and stop being offended by it, because I know all of us can feel very comfortable that the person on the other side of us or sitting in front of us needs this, but until you own it, you have to own it. You have to wear it. It's you. It's them too, but don't worry about them. They've got their own problems. Abba's going to deal with them. They got to walk out their own salvation, right? Fear and trembling, Philippians 2:12. But you got to be walking out yours. So own it. It's yours. It's for you. Let's go before the Father. Avinu Malkeinu, our Father, our King. Father, we come before you, and we're really wanting to grow up, to mature, to fully embrace the maturity that in the transformation process of becoming Yeshua-like, to conform and transform into his image, because he is the example of what a fully mature member of your family, of your body, looks like, so that we are not entrapped by our desires and drawn away by our desires, but we're only seeking your desires, wanting to do what's right in your eyes, wanting to understand what it means to endure so that we can receive the crown of life, wanting to understand that every good and perfect gift comes from above, comes from you. Father, we're going to ask for wisdom. You say if anyone lacks, we should ask, and we're asking for wisdom. We're asking that you would guide us to those that would help to pass out your wisdom to us, to help us to understand the wisdom you've put in your word, that, Father, that we may understand and then take with that understanding action, that we can take action, so that you would see the proving of our belief in our action. So, Father, we thank you for these opportunities called trials. We thank you for the opportunities to demonstrate to ourselves and to you just where we are in our walk so that we can then make the adjustments. We have to, I should have said this earlier, Father, help us to understand that these are pop quizzes and not final exams. That these trials we're going through are quizzes, not final exams. And by the way, these quizzes, if we grow, will not be held against us in our final grade. I really believe that if you pass the quiz by growing and learning more about you and making adjustments, Abba will not hold you. Father, do not hold that against us that we had parts of those that we got wrong on the test, so to speak. But if you ignore and are complacent and just don't want to hear what he's trying to have you hear and see what he's having you see in your trial, well, then that quiz score will count against you. Because you missed the point of the quiz. Father, help us not to miss the point. Help us to truly understand what it is you're doing to us, through us, for us, around us, so that your goal of having us become the type of person, Yeshua-like person that you'd want to spend forever with, that your purpose will come true, will be accomplished in us. Because we also understand that we can derail that whole thing by having our desires draw us away from you. So, Father, we thank you. We praise you. We appreciate your patience, your mercy, and your compassion so much as we are so flawed and so damaged and so broken, but yet we want so much to keep walking forward, keep walking forward, keep walking forward. So, Father, we thank you. We ask that you would walk with us, hold us and guide us, encourage us along the way. As we come before you now, in the name of your Son and our Savior, Yeshua, our Messiah, amen, amen.